It's called protein degradation. And if you're a bad protein in a cancer cell, you'd better get your affairs in order. Because now, thanks to Dana-Farber's foundational work, protein degradation can target cancer-causing proteins and destroy them, right inside the cell. This take-no-prisoners approach is making a difference in multiple myeloma and other blood cancers, and is how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Learn more at DanaFarber.org/everywhere.
Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
A not hypothetical question in this pandemic economy. Whose job, if anyone's, is it to do something about inflation? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Tuesday today. This one is the 19th of October. Good, as always, to have you along, everybody. 12 and a half days. What is that, I hear you asking? That's how long, on a rolling average, container ships are spending at anchor off the port of Los Angeles, waiting to pull in and unload. For those keeping track, last week when I gave you that statistic, it was 11 and a half days. So the supply side problems we are having in this economy ain't necessarily getting any better. Consider that to be in service of this. Today, the consumer products behemoth Procter & Gamble said it is going to raise prices on a bunch of stuff: skincare products, oral care products, razors as well. P&G says we can thank those aforementioned transportation costs due to the congestion, as well as a shortage of raw materials. But the company says it's trying to do some inflation mitigation, too. Marketplace's Justin Ho gets us going with that one.
Procter & Gamble says it's identifying backup suppliers, piling up extra raw materials, even reformulating some of its products with materials that are available. Jonathan Gold with the National Retail Federation says a lot of manufacturers and retailers have been getting creative.
This includes bringing product in earlier than they normally would, looking at other ports. You've certainly seen larger retailers who have chartered their own vessels.
Procter & Gamble says these kinds of strategies can help the company control costs. David Marcotte at Kantar Consulting says companies are also trying to ensure that people are even able to find their products in the first place.
They have to have not only one plan, but two plans, three plans, an alternative to be sure that they can get product to market.
Given the backups at factories and ports, the shortage of truck drivers, and everything else that's clogging supply chains, Wendy Liebman, CEO of WSL Strategic Retail, says there's a lot to be gained from store shelves that at least appear reasonably well-stocked.
Even if it's not, you know, six deep on a shelf, even if it's three deep on a shelf.
Empty store shelves, she says, can erode the public's confidence in a store and the brand they're looking for.
And especially when you're in an essentials everyday category like cleaning products, laundry detergent, paper towels, pet supplies.
And if those staples aren't available, she says that can even erode people's confidence in the entire economy. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Inflation, schminflation, all green on the major indices today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Should you be in the mood for some high-risk, high-volatility investing? Well, look, first of all, might I suggest you clear that idea with your financial advisor first? But assuming you get the green light, there is a crypto opportunity that might be of interest. Because as of today, you can buy an exchange-traded fund, ETF in the vernacular, that tracks Bitcoin futures. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore explains what's going on with that.
The ticker is BITO. You can look it up on the NYSE and buy it just like you could Tesla or Apple or whatever other stock. But if you did buy it,
you would not actually be owning Bitcoin. You would just be speculating on the price of Bitcoin.
James Angel is a professor of finance at Georgetown. The Bitcoin ETF is based on Bitcoin futures, which are a type of contract. Long story short, you're buying a financial product whose value is based on another financial product whose value is based on Bitcoin. The point is, you can invest in Bitcoin without buying a Bitcoin. Simeon Hyman is with ProShares, the firm that created the Bitcoin ETF. He says this is a big step in making cryptocurrency mainstream.
The more participants in various pieces of this market, the more liquidity transparency will be a part of the process as it matures and evolves.
And he says it's all under government supervision.
The futures market is a regulated place.
That may draw in a lot of interest from investors. Taxes are a little easier if you invest this way. And there's no concern over your Bitcoin wallet getting hacked, says Amy Wall, who represents taxpayers before the IRS.
But the fact that it's now an ETF is going to make people think it's safer. That's, I guess, the concern that I've got about it.
She says this might attract more investment from retirement accounts and pensions, but it's still just betting on Bitcoin.
It's not less volatile, okay? It's just as volatile as it ever was. It's just as up and down as it ever was. People make and lose fortunes, you know, on a daily basis. That is not different just because it's in an ETF.
So she says, don't bet any more than you're willing to lose. As of this afternoon, BITO had sold more than 20 million shares. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
The pandemic has been tough on relationships. We have all heard the stories, right? But there is one very specific kind of relationship that's kind of in a class by itself. Tenants and landlords. The billions of dollars in federal assistance that was supposed to keep renters in their homes and make landlords whole has been agonizingly slow getting to the people who need it. And most of that money is still not there. One exception to the tension is Philadelphia, where they've got an eviction diversion program. Before landlords can evict tenants for not paying their rent, those landlords first have to apply for rental assistance and go through mediation with the tenant. Of the more than 2,000 mediations so far, more than 90% have been resolved, or the parties agreed to keep on negotiating. But as Marketplace's Amy Scott reports, mediation can only go so far.
When Andrea Brown met up with her landlord, Moshe Atas, recently at Community Legal Services in Philadelphia, she took the opportunity to tease him about his new short haircut. She liked it better long.
He has like hair like, what's his name, Mick Jagger?
Atas manages several properties for an investor, including the row house Brown has been renting for 3 years. And you'd never know they'd been anything but friendly.
We have good relationship, although I took her twice to court, right?
Well, good might be a stretch. Twice he took her to court. The first time was before the pandemic, when Brown broke her leg, couldn't work as many hours as a home health aide, and fell behind on her rent. Atas filed an eviction. Ultimately, Brown came up with the money and stayed in her home. Then, a few months later, COVID arrived. She and her partner both lost their jobs, and their kids had to go to school online.
How can I work if I have 5 children that's not in school? I've been a teacher. I've been a therapist. I'm doing mom stuff, but I can't pay the rent because I don't have a job.
As of last October, Brown was $5,600 behind. By then, there was a federal eviction moratorium in place, and the city of Philadelphia had enacted its own protections. Before a landlord could take any steps to remove a tenant affected by COVID-19, both parties had to go through mediation. That's when Megan Karakellian entered the picture.
I'm a volunteer with the city of Philadelphia's Eviction Diversion Mediation Program.
A conference call was arranged with tenant, landlord, mediator, and a housing counselor from a local nonprofit. Kara Kellyan says first she laid the ground rules. Be respectful and courteous, no interruptions. Her job is to be neutral, but she understands the inherent power imbalance in the landlord-tenant relationship. She tried to put Brown at ease.
Because it is a formal program, there's a little bit of trying to remove that threat and saying that no one's in trouble here. And yes, you owe the landlord a lot of money, but you also have rights.
Brown also had some complaints. She says a plumbing leak had caused part of the ceiling to collapse and several heaters weren't working. She had a chance to air her concerns and says it was a totally different experience than when Atas took her to court.
They speak in the court language that you don't understand, and the lawyers there, they're way more educated than you, and you don't know what to say. You're like, you're nervous. So mediation actually had a chance for us to sit down and talk to each other like human beings.
In about an hour, they worked out a deal. Brown had already applied for rental assistance from the city. Until it came through and she could pay off her debt, Atas would lower the rent from $850 to $700. They agreed to split the cost of the outstanding water bill, and Atas would make repairs. He says he prefers mediation, too. For one thing, evictions are expensive.
I think business-wise, it is the right thing to do. We should keep the tenant at home.
Now, here's where you might expect me to say everything worked out, but it didn't. After the mediation last fall, Brown got some rental assistance, but not nearly enough. She still couldn't work, and after making one monthly payment, she stopped. Months went by.
So when I failed to do my part of agreement, then that's when he was able to file for eviction.
And that brings us to the second time they wound up in court. A hearing was scheduled for August. Even though a federal eviction moratorium was still in place, Brown feared the worst. She packed up her house and took the kids to her mom's place.
I just didn't want to have them in that type of situation. Police coming, they locking the door, you grabbing plastic bags or trying to throw whatever you can in. I don't want them to ever experience that.
But when she showed up in court, she got a surprise. Atas revealed that $9,000 in additional rental assistance had finally come through, just $560 short of what Brown owed. During a break in the proceedings, Atas looked over at Brown.
And then I closed my computer, went to Andrea and said, Andrea, let's talk.
So they went outside and they talked. Brown says their previous mediation made that possible.
I look at him like he's not my enemy, so why can't I talk to him? And we work something out on our own without the lawyer and the judge.
That just makes me so happy that they were able to have that conversation.
That's mediator Megan Karakellian, after I told her what happened.
That's the whole point of the program, is to just create a non-threatening dialogue.
Brown agreed to pay the $560 within 3 days, and she did. With her kids back in school, she had a new job.
She's caught up, right? Except for this month. We said Monday. Yeah.
So I'll be caught up on Monday.
That was a few weeks ago. When I checked in recently, Brown had bad news. She and her family had all come down with COVID, and she'd fallen behind on the rent again. In Philadelphia, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Figuring out if someone is lying.
I mean, how hard can it be, right? First, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials up 198 points today. Sounds like a lot. It's basically about 0.5%, 35,457. The NASDAQ up 107.7 tenths%, 15,129. The S&P 500 added 33, about 0.75%, landed at 45.19. $2.5 billion worth of COVID vaccine. That's how much Johnson & Johnson projects it will have sold by the end of the year. The company reported a strong third quarter and boosted its projected income. Shares of J&J, that is the name of the company, also the ticker symbol JNJ, pocketed 2.3% today. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.64%. I was only going a day. What'd y'all do? 1.64%? You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We have got, as you might have heard, a time or two, and that's on this program today alone, a supply chain problem in this economy. And it's a problem in almost every industry, including pharmaceuticals. Part of the bigger problem is that most of the ingredients for generic and over-the-counter drugs produced in the United States are imported mainly from China and India. So when those countries cut their exports during the pandemic, it became a problem here. But as Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports, the government is working on a solution.
Drive almost 3 hours south of Washington, D.C., and you come to a winding back road in rural Petersburg, Virginia. Here you'll find the beginnings of the pharmaceutical ingredient stockpile, several construction sites set back in the woods, and standing near the project's headquarters, Frank Gupton, one of the brains behind the operation.
Frank.
How are you?
Gupton heads Virginia Commonwealth University's Medicines for All Institute, a group of chemists who work to make pharmaceutical manufacturing more efficient. They're one of four contractors receiving federal funding to help create the stockpile. We walk over to a complex of hulking buildings behind barbed wire.
So this is the manufacturing site where we're going to be making the active pharmaceutical ingredients.
Two buildings are under construction here for the production of active pharmaceutical ingredients used to make generic drugs like antibiotics and sedatives. When the buildings are done and manufacturing starts, Gupton says some of the ingredients will be used right away to make drugs for hospitals. Some could be sold to U.S. drug manufacturers, and some will end up in the government stockpile, stored in a warehouse being built down the road to be used in an emergency, like another pandemic.
Yeah, it's very much modeled after the Strategic Petroleum Reserve.
That's a big pool of crude oil that can be tapped if there's a disruption in the energy market. Gupton says they're a bit behind schedule, but should get back on track to finish construction on the two buildings late next year or early in 2023. The delays, ironically, are from bottlenecks in the supply chain for construction materials.
Concrete, steel, everything. It's not just affected the timeline, it's affected the cost of the project.
Any extra costs are the responsibility of the stockpile project partners under the terms of their $354 million contract with the Department of Health and Human Services. Rena Conti has been keeping tabs on the stockpile project from her perch as a health economist at Boston University. She says there are strings attached to this government money.
It's not like there's a blank check written. It comes with responsibilities and benchmarks.
Benchmarks like staying on schedule. The contract doesn't appear to dictate what the stockpile partners can charge for any drug ingredients they decide to sell to U.S. drug makers. The CEO of one of the partners, a company called Flow, has been accused of overcharging in the past when he headed a different pharmaceutical company. Mariana Socal teaches about U.S. pharmaceutical policy at Johns Hopkins. She wants some price transparency.
We know we should be informed of what is the agreed upon price. And that's possible and feasible because we have seen this happen during the COVID-19 pandemic.
When the federal government announced what it would pay for COVID vaccines, for example. Back at the construction site, Frank Gupton says some of the pharmaceutical ingredients could be sold to U.S. drug makers. He won't say at what cost, but he thinks prices can be kept down through efficiency and automation. He says they can't overcharge because then they won't be able to compete with China and India.
So if we're not competitive against our global manufacturers, then they won't buy from us. It's pretty simple.
Gupton says he and his partners will be transparent with the government about what it takes to make quality pharmaceutical ingredients, so it'll be obvious if, say, China is selling pharmaceutical ingredients below cost at a price no U.S. manufacturer could match. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
It's not really any of my business, and I do ask non-lasciviously. I really do. But what are you wearing? Are you still at home and dressing for a professional Zoom up top, but maybe sweatpants and flip-flops out of camera range? Or are you back at the office and the dress code has perhaps slipped a little bit? It's relevant because there is news today that the clothing rental company Rent the Runway is going to go public, aiming for a valuation of as much as $1.5 billion. How, though, to make the subscription clothing model make sense in this pandemic clothing moment? Marketplace's Caroline Champlin is on it.
Before the pandemic started, Kate Lamberton rented a dress for a gala through a Rent the Runway subscription.
And then I didn't leave my house for the next 4 months.
And the dresses stayed in the closet.
I would look at those dresses and think, I wonder if I'll ever wear that again.
And like a lot of people, Lamberton, a marketing professor at the Wharton Business School, ended up canceling her subscription and actually hung on to the clothes.
I felt like somebody who kept a library book for too long, right? I was like, oh, I'm so embarrassed to send this back.
Keeping tabs on the products is one of the challenges of this business model. Because, says Forrester analyst Sucharita Kodali,
they have the complexity of both outbound logistics as well as reverse logistics, and both are beasts.
So as part of those reverse logistics, the company has to pay to have the clothes dry cleaned and sometimes repaired. Then there's the trend towards casual wear. Rent the Runway has mostly been geared towards dressy or business casual.
We're still not back to work. And I don't know that we're going to be back to work in the way that we were back to work in 2019.
Kodali says, with that in mind, it might be a difficult time for an IPO. But Wharton professor Lamberton says consumer surveys she's done show people may be ready to dress up again.
And what we're finding is that when people think about reconnecting with those that they haven't seen for a long time, they want to have been transformed.
Transformed, perhaps, by trying out designer brands. I'm Caroline Champlin for Marketplace.
On the theory that a lot of us in the holiday season to come will, and actually a lot of us for years now have been doing it. All right, a couple of more minutes now on what you just heard Caroline Champlin talk about as retail's reverse logistics economy returns to you and me. Amanda Mull wrote in The Atlantic the other day about what actually happens when you drop that unwanted piece of merchandise at FedEx or UPS. And it turns out said merchandise does not necessarily just get scanned and put right back on the shelf.
That is not what happens at all. And I think that that's what most people assume,
yeah,
because you don't think about the process of figuring out if someone is lying to get their money back.
Yeah.
And about 5 to 10% of returns from online shopping are fraud.
I'm surprised it's that low, to be honest with you.
Honestly, so was I.
Yeah.
But 5 to 10% of hundreds of billions of dollars of merchandise is still a pretty big amount.
So let me ask you this, though. Once they figure out what's fraudulent, what's dirty, this and that, do they actually pick your e-commerce retailer? Do they actually stick it back on the shelves and wait for the next picker to come along?
It sort of depends. Some retailers are better situated to do this than others. For some of them, it depends on the particular good that's been sold. Electronics, for instance, if those have your personal information on it, or if they might, usually those are going to be stripped for parts. If it has usable parts, likely part of it gets resold.
What if it's like a blouse or a pair of pants or something?
That depends on how nice the blouse or pair of pants is.
Okay, it's an average blouse and an average pair of pants. I mean, you know.
If it's an average blouse or pair of pants and it's coming back brand new in packaging, it might get put back into the new sales stream, or it might get offloaded to an outlet. But a lot of stuff does just get thrown away. About 25% is the estimate that I got.
That's crazy. 25% of returns?
Mm-hmm. As everyone emphasized to me, and as I feel compelled to keep saying, it really depends based on product category.
Yeah,
but
yeah, yeah.
Overall, the estimate is about a quarter.
So that speaks ill of us as a consuming public. But anyway, this has all, I'm sure, been exacerbated by the fact that we all bought so much more stuff than usual online during the pandemic and have continued to do that.
Yes. Online shopping has grown an enormous amount during the pandemic. So you get a lot of people ordering a lot of stuff online that they're either unfamiliar with or stuff that they're familiar with, but they would have gotten it in stores before. Not only does that, you know, add to online shopping, which has a higher overall return rate anyway, but it's going to spike that return rate up above normal because it's pushing people into shopping circumstances they're not used to or comfortable with.
Yeah. And the other part is, you know, companies are pushing their customers into online sales in an attempt to compete, however vainly, with like the Amazons. The challenge, of course, is that the Amazons have the scale to be able to handle the returns, and maybe your fledgling-ish e-retailer just doesn't.
Right. We're in a retail environment in which a couple of very, very large companies, and none of them larger than Amazon, pretty much set the terms of retail sales and set the expectations. And
number one of which, by the way, excuse me for interrupting, but number one of which is free returns.
Right. Free returns are a huge thing, especially when you're trying to encourage people who might be unfamiliar with your business to trust you. But if you're a small business and, you know, you've got a much lower number of people trying to process returns and process refunds, there's just not enough scale to absorb some of these costs.
Right. So since reporting this out, have your shopping and, more importantly, your return habits changed?
Yes. You know, I have written about consumerism for years, but learning about all of this has really, even me, somebody who knows a lot about this, has really made me think twice almost every time I go to order something.
Amanda Mull, she's a staff writer at The Atlantic, writing this time about returns. Amanda, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
This final note on the way out today, there is a job opening coming up at the International Monetary Fund. Geeta Gopinath, the IMF's chief economist, a guest on this program probably 3-4 times the past 3 years, said today she is going back to Harvard at the end of the year. Her latest growth forecast, by the way, has the global economy growing at 4.9% next year. All right, we got to go. Here's your moment of economic context real quick today, because I think I talked too much. Crude oil, the U.S. benchmark West Texas Intermediate, almost $83 a barrel today. But get this, in the past 7 weeks, that is since the beginning of September, WTI up 21%. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Siobhan Brett, Dylan Miettinen, Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.